Yeah. We're back. The Fifth Estate is back. It's been, it's funny. It's been nearly almost a year since the show went into hiatus. And then I was thinking about bringing it back. And for some reason, I thought I should get a new another co-host. And I talked to Ben Howe, who was like, he was interested in doing a podcast. And then Ben said, and so he said, why don't we just bring you on here? And that was it. And Ben is the new co-host. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. And we got a news gal. Andrea Ruth is the news gal.
Hola.
Ah. So we'll be hearing from her throughout the show. All right. So, not going to take too much time here doing introductions, all that stuff. We'll talk about some stuff at the end. Just to sit there and say that if you like what you hear and you like this podcast, go out to iTunes, give it a 5-star rating, leave a review. If you think it's worth less than 5 stars, then just forget about it. Otherwise, we'd love to hear from you. So, all right.
If you want to know more about me, by the way, you can go to the website and read the bio about Neil Doing.
Yeah, the bio still has Neil Doing's information up there, but there is that. We're working on Ben's bio. He's so many accomplishments. He just can't squeeze
really
it all in
long,
one paragraph.
And I need to make sure that I squeeze everything in there.
All right. So one of the things we wanted to talk about, kind of big news in the inside baseball world of politics, really more than anything else, is Eric Erickson, who was part of kind of the Never Trump movement back in early 2016. That hashtag actually was created by, I'm sure if he doesn't care if we say his name, Aaron Gardner, friend of ours and everything. He created the Never Trump hashtag, and then Eric used it in an article, and it just kind of went crazy, and that's become this like new thing, whether somebody deems it a positive thing or somebody using it as a negative connotation. It's just become something that's stuck. Eric,
it's taken on its own life in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
There's like different factions even within Never Trump now. And a lot of people who are huge Trump supporters, it's sort of a blanket statement. But there's lots of different levels of Never Trump. You've got the Tom Nichols corner, and you've got Rick Wilson, and Eric Erickson was, and people still call me that. I just never really identify as that myself these days.
Yeah, I don't either. I kind of argued that once the election happened, it was kind of over. Now, granted, there'll be another election, but it was like, okay, Never Trump is dead. He won, and that's all there is to it. And I think for guys like me and you, probably been more about calling balls and strikes, saying, hey, if he does something good, we're going to say it's good. But we're not at the same time, that faction of Never Trump that you talked about, like the Tom Nichols and the Max Boots and everything, who have gone out and encouraged people to vote for Democrats because they think Trump is so bad and the GOP is so evil now and just needs to lose power in order to rebuild. I don't necessarily agree with that. And I wrote, Tom had written why he left the GOP in the Atlantic, and I wrote a kind of like a response saying why I'm sticking around because I'm not going to give up the party to Donald Trump. There's people who talked about that he's a transformational figure. Others have, like me, think he's a transitional figure, that he's not. It's not going to hold.
Mm-hmm. I think Eric fell somewhere closer, prior to this most recent conversion he's gone through. He was more on the balls and strikes team. But now, what he's saying is he's not just, I'm relenting and I'm going to pull the lever. He's saying if they want his support, even on the campaign trail, he's willing to do that.
Right.
Which is a big, big move.
It is. This is no longer just, cause there were a lot of people that went into 2016 and voted for Trump, kind of like, it's better than Hillary. And that's how Eric is not going into this. Now he's saying, I'm throwing my full support behind a Trump reelection effort, and I'm willing to help out to do it. His piece, he talks about some of the things that he still doesn't like, that he said, is Trump's character and the trade deals and everything like that. But I have a hard time getting past the whole Well, I don't like his character, but because of the results, I'm going to be okay with it. I
which is really, I mean, and we're both friends with Eric, so I disagree with him. I'm not saying he's like a bad person for this, but it's hard to not identify that as the exact opposite of what we were saying. Why weren't voting in the first place? It was never outcome related. There was no question that Trump would be to the right of Hillary. The whole point was his character. So if the whole point was his character, I'm not sure what level of accomplishments suddenly reverses that. Like, it's not as though, at least not as how I understood Eric's position or a lot of other people who had called themselves Never Trump, it's not as though they were saying, I'm Never Trump because I don't think there's going to be any outcomes I'm going to like. They were saying this person brings a level of character that is unfit for the office and will have detrimental effects on the conservative movement going forward, regardless of policy outcomes. Wasn't that your decision?
Yeah, I mean, nobody actually thought he was going to nominate his sister to be on the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, that was just this kind of thing where people joked about it. You know, he had said even before the election, he had a list of judges that everybody knew the Federalist Society had put together. And he was just going to sit there and listen to people say, take this guy, take that guy, or whatever. And that's what it's going to be. And am I happy about the judicial choices? Absolutely. But does that change the overall feeling that I have about Trump and what he's done to the movement and everything else? No, because I think he's done one of the things I said that he would do long-term damage to the party. And I think that there has been a lot of short-term gain for long-term damage. And I think part of that is, you know, was the House, losing the House. And now you've got, you know, this kind of like reversal situation where people are like, oh, well, Trump is like, we want someone that's going to be just as far to the left as Trump has been behaving to the right. And so that's why you have so far about 3,800 Democrats who've jumped into the race and are advocating policies that are even to the left of Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And their personalities, I think, are trying to reflect a sort of answer to Trump. You've got Kamala Harris out there. You know, well, I was smoking pot and listening to Snoop Dogg, you know what I mean? And like they're all trying to be the realest real, and they're getting on Instagram and showing themselves cooking, and AOC or, Ocasio-Cortez, who's not a not running for president, I understand, but is a rising star of the Democrat Party. She's pulling kind of the fake news thing, going after the media all the time. They're doing the same kinds of stuff, just to the left.
Right.
And I think that that's somewhat encouraged by the culture that Donald Trump has brought to the presidency.
Yeah. And Andrea, how many candidates on the Democratic side have officially jumped in?
Oh gosh, I think 10 at this point.
10. All right. Yeah. So it's like the biggest names, of course, are Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and who am I missing? Is that it? Is that the big four?
Is there don't forget John Delaney. Ojeda.
Ojeda. I mean, like the major party candidates. I mean, I guess you could say Julian Castro is, even though he was like the mayor of San Antonio. But there's still others out there. Bernie Sanders hasn't officially gotten in yet, and he will likely become one. Joe Biden is still weighing a decision, and I don't think that he's going to pass it up this time. I think he's going to jump in. And of course, Beto O'Rourke is another one who is, you know, and which goes back to the whole thing about, you know, it's like people are looking for someone, you know, to want to like get behind. And Beto O'Rourke is a guy who, you know, lost his last election. Never did anything of any kind of, you know, have no real accomplishments while he was in the House. And now everyone's saying, let's make this guy president. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think that's something I think would have happened without Trump. We're just moving towards this cult of personality election process. And it's been going on for decades, really. I mean, you recall all the way back in the Kennedy versus Nixon, when the first televised debate,
right,
was when they said that, you know, everything had changed, and it's all been moving in this direction. It's all about their life story, not about whether or not they might be a competent leader. And Beto, I think, fits right into that category. Because I don't see what he's done that should make anybody confident in his ability to be president. Other than that, they think it's really cool he was in a band.
Yeah, he was in a band and he skateboards and, you know.
I mean, this guy air drums in the car. I mean, like, that's...
Badly.
That really... Right. But that's apparently just, wow, you know, that's gonna turn a lot of heads.
Right. Well, party leaders party insiders, I should say, are looking at the fact that he can raise money like nobody's business. I mean, the guy raised like 30-something million dollars in the last like 28 days of the campaign against Ted Cruz. But then again, I don't know if that's going to work the same way, because I think there's just, you know, people just, there is a kind of visceral hatred for Ted Cruz. Even among some Republicans who thought that he sold out with the whole Trump thing, that I don't see, there's probably a lot of people that wrote checks to Beto O'Rourke that likely wouldn't in a presidential race.
Well, yeah, you get that darling status and it's hard to shake it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the late night talk show hosts and they got invested in his election. So him losing, it's like they invested all this money and all this time.
Yeah.
And they want to get something out of it. So, hey, let's get him to run for president.
So at least Vanity Fair is now giving him a feature article.
Yeah. I mean, there hasn't been any magazine profiles of Beto O'Rourke. So it's a good thing that there's somebody finally getting on that.
I'd be so pissed. Like, if this was what was happening, I'd be like, what are you guys doing? We've got all these, they've got people to choose for. If I were a Democrat and I were fully committed to, you know, everything that the Democrat Party believes in, how are you not like asking for Bernie Sanders, who almost won against Hillary? It seems like he would be the obvious choice if you were a Democrat.
Yeah. No, and you have the others who have already officially jumped in, and yet, you know, the O'Rourke gave that counter speech to Trump in El Paso, and that was like a big deal. Like thousands of people showed up for it. He's still the flavor of the month, I think, in media circles. You know, so
he'll be VP, right? That's probably what will end up happening.
What's that?
He'll be the VP.
Yeah, I mean, if he doesn't get through, he'd probably be a good choice for VP, whoever the nominee is. Which, you know, I mean, we still don't really know. Yeah, this is kind of crazy. We're you know, it's only February of 2019. You know, we haven't even moved into the summer of 2019 when this stuff starts to get fleshed out.
The never-ending presidential election cycle.
It's crazy. It doesn't even feel like we got out of 2016 before this even started. So getting back to what Eric said, though. I mean, and I know this is going to, a lot of people are going to be upset. A lot of people, you know, this the same old people that are going to be yelling about, you know, it's funny, guys like you and I and others who are not necessarily the rabid anti-Trumpers, but, you know, the people like us who are critical of him are, you know, in this group of Never Trump who are supposedly irrelevant. We're just the irrelevant people. We no longer have any power. We want it back. We have no relevance. But if Trump loses in 2020, it'll be our fault.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
It was the same throughout the that was a constant throughout the 2016 election cycle, was that our irrelevance was only so irrelevant because we're traitors and are ultimately going to cause, you know, 1,000 years of darkness by getting Hillary elected as a result of our indifference to Trump, which is really hard to pull off when you're supposed to be irrelevant. But they, you know, that's part of their meme. And you know what's also interesting is I spend so much less time complaining about or bitching about Trump himself these days. I'm mostly focused on how his supporters support him, the ways that they support him, the things that they say to rationalize, the attitudes they have. I mean, it's when he was running and I was Never Trump, it was about preventing that. Preventing people from becoming like that. But so once he won, the reason I'm not Never Trump anymore is because now we're at that part where that's how they are. And so my biggest beef is that all of these people who had claimed to believe all sorts of things were suddenly abandoning all of it in favor of one person. So it's less about him and it's more about them to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And then when you see that, when you see like the you know, support of the tariffs, which, you know, if you know, you always look at it, you say, if Barack Obama had done with tariffs what President Trump has done, there would be calls for his impeachment, and there would be, I mean, it would be out of this, it would be insane. But now it's a negotiating tactic and we're winning, and it's like,
everything is brilliance, everything.
Yeah, everything. Like everything is 4D chess. Everything is a plan.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, when they lost the House, first of all, it's not that unusual to lose the House in a midterm when you have the incumbent president. You know, that's not that unusual.
No,
there's a way to spin that's fairly normal, which is to say, you know, well, here's what we did keep, and here's what some of the polls show, and here's what we can learn or whatever. Instead, Trump comes out and is basically like, you know what, honestly, this is better. And he starts talking about how things weren't making it out of the Congress because the Republicans weren't getting along well enough or whatever. And if we had won, but by a small margin, then things would have continued to get stuck in the House. But now the Democrats will be there. So that means it'll get pushed through so it could be debated in the Senate, which will lead us to negotiation. So really, it was like a long way of him saying, yeah, this was all part of the plan. Like, we wanted this.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. And you know, of course they won this, you know, they won a couple of seats in the Senate. So that was more important as well. But, and the loss, even though you said it was better, but everyone said the reason why they lost the House was because of Paul Ryan. It was Paul Ryan's fault.
Right. Well, and also Mia Love and others who didn't, you know, come into his room and kiss his ring.
Yes. Yes. They all lost as a result. It had nothing to do with suburban voters sitting there saying, this guy, this is just too much. I'm going to switch over and vote on this side.
If it was all according to the plan. However, to the extent that it wasn't part of the plan, it was other people's fault.
Yeah, that's, you know, it. Perfect.
It's basically his position.
So, I mean, do you think we're going to see more people like Eric coming around saying, you know, I mean, I've seen it. I've seen a couple of people, some people we know on Twitter. I've seen, you know, sitting there saying, screw this, I'm voting for Trump. I never thought I would, but now I'm going to. And mostly a lot of it I've seen is because of the mainstream media. You know, they said the media has just been so bad in covering Trump. They said that. Now, I don't buy that rationale. I can't see. Look, yeah, the media is bad. But do you think Maggie Haberman's going to give a shit if I vote for Donald Trump to stick it to her? I mean, she's just going to be like, okay, so.
Yeah. It's not like we elect people on CNN. I mean, you know, they're going to be there and they're going to do what they're going to do. It doesn't really matter who wins. In fact, their ratings go up the more they're hated. So I'm just not. Donald Trump and the kinds of people who would call CNN fake news and everything, is there any denying that they have experienced a ratings boom over the last couple of years? I can't imagine why the majority of Trumpist mentality growing is going to be bad for the news networks. It's not going to affect them. It's not going to send them a message.
No. No.
And then, on you know, in addition to that, like the idea that CNN is ever going to give a fair shake, or MSNBC is ever going to give a fair shake, no matter how many times they get called out for anything, it's impossible. It's never going to happen.
Yeah, no, it's never going to happen. And the other thing is that, you know, it's like there's, I heard there's this Kevin Williamson and Charles Cook were talking about the press, and you know, there are so many elements of the press that do a good job, you know, like the New York Times international side, and I think the New York Times investigative reporting team has done well. It's really the daily coverage that is so terrible, because Trump says something. I've even gotten to the point where it's like I'll laugh at some stuff that Trump says on Twitter, but it's like there is still this, everybody's waiting for him to tweet, and when they do, the outrage meter still goes to 11. And it's kind of like he's been doing this for nearly 4 years.
Right. Right.
You know, and it's kind of like the lock her up chance. And I'm saying, why are you reporting this? I mean, yeah. You know, it's not news anymore. They're going to chant lock her up at every rally.
For me, it's not even the bias anymore, because a lot of times he's been such a shit show. that a lot of the bias, I'm like, is it really bias? They're just saying he's an asshole. He is. You know, like, it's kind of hard to deny, but it's the drama. Like, they're so freaking dramatic about everything and how they talk about it and the way that Acosta deals with it, how he's always doing, like, emo poetry when he gets on Twitter later because it makes it grotesque and so easy to hate, even if you're listening to a report you agree with. Oh, I mean, there's times where Acosta or somebody is saying something, I'm like, no, he's right. These guys are being jerks and these guys are doing something wrong. But I hate you so much that I can barely hear what you're telling me because I'm just hating your poetry.
Right. It's the whole, you know, this whole idea that they're so filled with righteousness and just you know, it's like, yes, has Trump blasted the press? Has he said stupid things about the press? Has he actually?
He's even said dangerous things. I'll give them that.
Yeah, no, he said dangerous things. But the thing is, has he done any dangerous thing? And I'm not saying it's like you ignore his words, because I've written columns about his attacks on the press, and I do think that they're dangerous rhetorically. But at the same time, he hasn't done anything the way Woodrow Wilson did, which specifically was trying to remove, you know, their access, trying to get, you know, trying to, like, you know, take away their rights to print what they want.
Wait, I just want to make sure. Did you just do a whataboutism with Woodrow Wilson?
I didn't.
Because that's a new one for me. I've seen people do Obama, but I haven't seen anybody go, whoa, Trump did this? Well, Woodrow Wilson.
His visit to the National Portrait Gallery is getting in his brain.
Yeah. Well, you know, I still have visions of him and Andrew Jackson. Why are there so many? You go to that portrait gallery, just as an aside, there's so many photos and busts and everything of Andrew Jackson. It's like, what the hell is going on around here? They even have, like, a hipster Andrew Jackson thing. His hair is, like, super high and wavy.
That's Trump's favorite president.
I guess. Maybe he's been ordering, making...
After Bannon told him who he was, probably. but, you know, since then, he's become some kind of Jackson authority.
Yeah. All right. So you know, in any event, you know, the press, like... One thing I do like to say, though, it's kind of funny, and I tweeted at Acosta from time to time, is... I watched a masterclass thing with Bob Woodward, and he was talking about what is journalism and answering the question, what is journalism? And he says, you know, you see these press conferences at the mayor's office or the White House, and these reporters are sitting there shouting questions and everything. And he's like, that's not journalism. I was like, that's a backhanded slap at Jim Acosta, who thinks he's doing God's work by arguing with the president publicly at a press conference.
I really wouldn't be surprised if he carries a sword when he goes to press conferences. I mean, honestly. And he calls it Excalibur or something. I mean, he's so full of himself.
Yes.
And like it makes, you know, these things we're saying now, it's funny. You've got, you know, the strange new respect, right, that we all never Trumpers got from people on the left.
Yeah. Right.
And what's funny is, like, they'll hear us say things like this and they'll get pissed at us and say, you know, I think there's bigger problems than that. And you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. Were you a salon approved conservative, Ben? I can't remember.
Oh,
were you
on I was a salon con. Were you on the list?
I was. Salon approved.
Oh, that's right. They said you're great unless you talk about guns.
Yeah, then I'm a wacko.
Right, right. What they said about me was that I don't mince words. But they also used a photo of me with my fake photoshopped ponytail. So
like, that's what they. Oh, they got what your current Twitter avatar is. What they used?
No, it's the one where full head. I have the mohawk on now.
Oh, okay. Oh, I remember the one you're talking about. Right.
Right. Right. But yeah, I'm a salon con. You know, or what is it that Slichter calls us?
Yeah, salon approved. He puts the hashtag salon approved. Yeah. Mm. So, yeah. So,
like, you know, what you were saying, you know, we got off on the media tangent, but what you were saying is right. A lot of people, they see the same things you and I are talking about the press. They have the same distaste, and that's part of the reason that they are switching. That right. They're saying, fine, I will vote for Trump.
Right.
Is that somehow the media pissing them off enough makes them do something that a couple of years ago they called immoral, which I don't understand.
But. Right. And it's gonna be the Flight 93 election again. Yeah, essentially, that's what's going to come down to. If you're not voting for Donald Trump, then you want to help destroy the country.
Well, no, the Flight 93 already happened. We're in the Afghanistan war now.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, we gotta keep with the timeline if we're going to be using really inappropriate metaphors.
Metaphors, yeah, okay, good call. All right, so you mentioned AOC before, moving on to kind of a new subject here. And the Green New Deal FAQ that I found out, I heard this, and Ben, maybe you, if you see FAQ, do you say FAQ or do you say FAQ?
I'm a normal human, so I say FAQ.
Right. I was listening to a commentary podcast, and Noah Rothman was like, the AOC FAQ. And Podhoretz and like the others were like, FAQ, what's a FAQ? He's like, the frequently asked questions. Oh, they're like, oh, FAQ. He's like, no, it's FAQ. Gamers say FAQ. So that's what it is.
No, like, okay. No, they do not.
Yeah. Andrea says FAQ. She said it's FAQ.
It's FAQ.
So you're a communist.
I tweeted at Jay earlier, if he says FAQ, I will just translate it in my own brain to FAQ, and we will move on from there. But in my head, it will be.
What does GIF spell?
That one goes back and forth. I mean, I grew up thinking it was GIF, but now I know that it's GIF. I kind of go back and forth with it, so. I'm ambidextrous with the GIF-GIF thing.
Well, I've never heard anybody call it FAQ, but more power to you.
Yeah, I mean, I ran a poll on Twitter, and FAQ won convincingly, but there was quite a few votes.
You have
FAQ.
Old followers.
No, I have normal followers is what I have.
Liberal followers.
I got the libs following me. All right, so speaking of the FAQ or the FAQ or whatever the hell you want to call it, So for background, I mean, most people probably know this, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, that everyone's refers to her as, she came up with this Green New Deal, which is this, you know, the New York Times, you know, called it, it gave it a nice term, calling it ambitious. I call it laughable, and funny and amusing, but apparently they had given a version of this bill. It was more of an outline. It really wasn't the entire legislation, but handed it to NPR along with and they put an FAQ on their website talking about what would this bill do and what would happen. And there was things in there about cow farts and kind of like eliminating not necessarily eliminating planes, but they said eliminating the necessity to having to fly. Because everybody'd get all over the place with, you know, high speed trains. Of course, it'd be interesting to see how to do that with, you know, Hawaii or something. But regardless, that's what they talked about. And what happened was, so it suddenly disappeared from the website. It was deleted. You go there, you get a 404. The tweets that they sent out were deleted. And AOC goes out there and actually starts saying that it was, you know, it was a hoax, that the cow farting thing and all this other stuff was a hoax, and it was made up.
Well, she was being clever, because what happened was a lot of people made jokes. You know, there were a lot of people that made fake versions of the FAQ to make fun of the FAQ, and so they conflated those two things and pretended as though the bigger problem or what was getting more attention were these actual fake ones, when in reality, what most people were bouncing off of and reacting to and making jokes about was the actual FAQ. And then they further tried to confuse the issue by pointing out that the ultimate bill did not reflect a lot of what was in that FAQ. Nobody's ever denied that it was a error, that it was a mistake, they didn't mean to let those come out. But to act as though an FAQ that had those types of things in it as the precursor to whatever ultimately was agreed to by many Democrats, to act as though that has no relation at all to the ultimate bill is ridiculous. It's not as though they abandoned all of these ideas just because they altered them in what ultimately got agreed to. But I think they were just trying to be clever to make it seem as though it was a right-wing conspiracy, and they were bouncing off the fact that there were actual jokes out there and pretending that was the problem.
Yeah, well, that was part of it, but I think they went a little further. I don't think she was trying to be clever. I think this was a legitimate example of gaslighting, where she was basically trying to convince people that what they had seen, they didn't really see. And you're right. I think you're right. I think she tried to conflate the actual fake stuff with what she just referred to as the draft that got uploaded. But no, you didn't just upload it. You took the draft and that same one, and that's the one you distributed to NPR. That's how the information got out there. And it's one of these things where
it's dumbfounding. Why can't you just defend your own FAQ?
Right.
Like, do you not like your own stuff that much that you can't just defend it and say, oh, you know what? We accidentally uploaded the wrong thing. And ultimately what we sent over was a little different. But of course I can defend these things. I thought them. Did think them or they wouldn't have written them.
Well, but again, that comes back to what you said before about AOC and the way she uses Twitter is kind of like the way Donald Trump does. That, you know, she's not going to defend what she did. She's just going to sit there and call it fake news, essentially.
Right.
You know, I've never seen anybody attack fact checkers the way that she has, you know. You know, what's his name from the one from the Washington Post? What's his name? Glenn
Greenwald?
No, that's I don't know.
Oh, that's the Russian Snowden guy.
Yes. Yeah, that's the Snowden guy. Glenn Kessler. So, and Kessler, you know, instead of just sitting there saying, hey, what we did was, you know, what you said was wrong, that's it. He went on to this thing. He tried to explain. He tried to, like, respond to her. And it's just kind of like all she's going to do at that point is sit there and declare victory. That you responded and said and tried to explain means that she's going to sit there and think, you know, well, you got it wrong. And now you're telling me why. Even though he was just kind of adding to the reason why they got it right, she's doing like Trump does and saying now they're trying to explain it away.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the kind of stuff that I think that both parties do. And long before Trump came along, even they did. It's just worse now. But it's the kind of thing that's what 2016 broke me of. I'm so tired of having to be afraid to explain something, you know, for a fear of how it looks or how certain people, if you think something, you just fucking say it and let people decide if they want to be on board with it or not. But all these little games to try to run away from the very things you wrote, how is that a trustworthy person that you can trust in the position they're in if they can't even stand up for the own things that they thought, that they have to pull all of these tricks to convince people that they didn't say them.
Right. And what kills me too is that people like, you know, so people like Joe Scarborough, who I'm friendly with, you know, he goes on air and he's like,
this Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Green New Deal, the impeachment, they think that they're the ones in control of the Democratic Party. It's Nancy Pelosi who's in charge. And I basically pointed out to him, I said, look, Joe, I said, I know you want to think Nancy has all this power. I said, but then why are presidential candidates like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, why are they? Kirsten Gillibrand is the one I missed earlier. Why are they getting on board with the Green New Deal? They're tweeting about it already, you know, and I had to remind him again today. It's like if one of them wins, if Cory Booker was to win and said, I want the Green New Deal bill on my desk, is Nancy Pelosi going to say no? If Democrats are in control, of course not. They're going to go ahead and they're going to pass it. Yeah, whether or not it survives is another question altogether.
Well, it's because so much is dependent on, you know, optics are one thing. It's one thing to be concerned about optics when it comes to something that's real. You know, you don't want to do something that looks bad when it shouldn't look bad. But that's not how optics are decided. Half the time these days, they're sort of decided ahead of it in terms of we don't really care what the facts are around this. We just want to make sure people think of something a certain way. And what all of these Democrats want is for people to think that they're on AOC's side, which is really it. They don't really care about the Green Deal. They don't really care about what it said. They know it's not going to pass. They just want to be thought of as being on her side because she's this young, fresh, new blood, and she's popular on Twitter, and she knows how to use it better or whatever.
Right.
And they don't want to look unhip. It's the most base, shallow form of politics you could imagine.
Yeah, well, I mean, going back to that, you talked before about, you know, them trying to use social media, and like Elizabeth Warren, when she did the beer thing, it was this kind of like very awkward, I'm going to drink a beer. You know, it was like Hillary when she did that, when she did the when she was on Snapchat, did the I'm chilling in Cedar Rapids.
Oh my God. Did you see John Kasich?
No. The yoga
report from his doorstep about how he started doing yoga. I'm not even kidding.
I saw
like
it.
The set.
I saw it.
It sounds like I'm filling out a Mad Libs, like John Kasich talking about yoga. Like, that's what we're looking for, really?
Yeah. I mean, they're trying. So, Andrea, you're a millennial. How does it feel to see like 60-something-year-old people trying to behave like 29-year-old people?
Exactly how you imagine it looks. It's pretty pathetic.
It's kind of like when your parents used to try and like get into your music. Yeah, I kind of like Metallica.
My parents never did that. My parents stayed, you know, typically uncool and stick with their own music. But yeah, I mean, the thing to remember here is that people and the class, that the incoming class of Democrats that are incoming with AOC, they don't like the establishment Democrats. And it's literally like watching the 2010 Republicans with the Tea Party, where, I mean, that's, I'm having flashbacks to that is what I'm feeling like this is really looking like more than anything else.
Yeah, but that's Tea Party
had their own little Carnival Barker as a candidate here at some point. I mean, they're going to get their own version, but they're on the same path, you know, to the stuff that we saw. They're on the same path. They've got the new blood coming in, the new blood. We wanted Tea Party libertarianism back in 2010, and then this new group wants intersectional socialism. And so they're all trying to sort of cater to that mentality.
I could never imagine in the 80s or even the early 90s, any Democratic members of Congress doing what like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have done in terms of, you know, just basic blatant anti-Semitism. You know, and you know, attacking the BDS movement, you know, I mean, and Omar comes out and she does this thing about it. It's all about the Benjamins, baby. I mean, it's like, are you telling me that she doesn't know about the whole Jewish money trope and she had to be told about it and be educated about it as a member of Congress?
Not attacking. You said attacking the BDS movement. You mean advocating
for it. I'm sorry. You're right. That's why we have Andrew here to kind of correct us when we're like sounding stupid, which is often for me anyway. Yeah. So I mean, that's, I could never imagine that. And now it's like, you know, it took days of this stuff for Democrats to sit there and say, okay, this is not good. You know,
I often hate the phrase credit where due when somebody's just doing something that they should do anyway. You know, like when somebody will say something like, hey, you know, credit where due. He said he doesn't like molesters. Okay, well, he doesn't get credit for that. He just shouldn't. You know, but so when it comes to stuff like this and people, hey, credit where due, the Democrats came out against anti-Semitism. Like, yeah, I mean, they should just do that. But okay, sure, credit where due. But what gets me is that while I saw a lot of people on the left, and I'm not talking about the politicians, but just voices and blue checks on Twitter, very willing to call it out early, you know, which I thought was good. What was interesting to me is that a lot of the people who were trying to defend it suddenly pretended things like dog whistles just don't exist.
Yeah.
You know, we've been hearing about dog whistles forever, and I believe they're real. And I believe people like Steve King use them. But to pretend all of a sudden that tropes don't exist, because why? She's a Democrat and she's above that, and so clearly she just didn't know. I just find it so unlikely, and I find it so unlikely that the people who were defending her found it unlikely themselves. Like, there's no way that they thought that she didn't know. They're just pretending to think she didn't know.
Right.
No one believes she didn't know.
Right. And if they're saying that, then they're lying. And that's why her apology was kind of like ridiculous. And then she said, you know, I unequivocally apologize. But then the next paragraph said, at the same time, well, wait a minute.
Which is an equivocation for kids at home.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like if you say you unequivocally apologize and then start the next sentence all saying, well, at the same time, you might as well just sit there and say, but, you know, I'm not a Trump supporter, but.
Let me equivocally apologize. That's what you should have said.
I mean, essentially what she did was similar to the I'm sorry if you were offended routine. It was kind of like one of those. It was just a half-assed apology. Just like, all right, Nancy's yelling at me. Let me just put this out there and that's going to be it. And of course, AOC jumps in and defends her and says, I'm glad she's bringing light to, to talking about, you know, like lobbyist money and stuff like
that. Yes, you know, like, that's the thing right there. That's the thing right there. The successful spins only work when there is when people can rationalize it in a way that allows them to look at themselves in the mirror. And so what people have done is they've morphed this away from it being a trope into, no, it was a larger commentary on the problems associated with lobbying, you know, any lobbying except Planned Parenthood, essentially. And that whole line of reasoning is just such baloney, because there's plenty of lobbying groups that they have no problem with. There's plenty of Citizens United stuff, you know, that they have no problem with. It all just depends on the agenda. Right. And I called people out on that the other night. I said, you know, don't complain to me about lobbying if you're going to exclude Planned Parenthood every single time. And these people came back at me and were like, well, there's a big difference between what the NRA does and what. And I'm like, no. You said lobbying. You didn't say what particular agenda. You said lobbying. So if you're saying it's about agendas, then we're back to saying that she was just talking about Jews. Because if you're going to focus it in like that, then you're screwing yourself, buddy.
Right. The argument kind of falls apart, you know, pretty quickly. Yeah. when you kind of pierce when they, yeah, that whole, this is a broader agenda about lobbying. And, you know, there was somebody wrote something stupid in New York Magazine today saying, you know, that, you know, a trap was set for Omar and she fell into it. When really it's very simple.
We pounce.
Yeah. It's very simple. The explanation for Republicans and why they're so defensive of Israel is very simple. It's right wing Christians who are, you know, causing them to be so supportive of Israel, you know, because of the whole biblical angle. You know, it's got nothing to do with the fact that Israel is the only nation in the Middle East that we can really consider an ally. That's a true democracy. And, you know, you were talking about people that were displaced 70 years ago from Europe as a result. Maybe that's the reason why we're so supportive of them. And they've helped us in fights against, you know, terrorists and things of that nature. No, it's because of the right wing Christians who are.
Do you think the Democrats are going to move away from, because, you know, it's been pretty bipartisan for a long time in terms of at least giving lip service to supporting Israel. Do you think the new blood is going to start turning that, because we've known for years that the underbelly of the left's base was very anti-Israel, very pro-Palestine, and had lots of issues that certainly sound anti-Semitic, but they were always cast as this fringe protest portion of the base and not really what the party supported. Do you feel that's shifting now?
I think so. I mean, you know, Barack Obama was, you know, not Barack Obama wasn't bad. I mean, you know, people sit there say he was bad for Israel. I don't think he was bad, but he also paid a lot of lip service to the Palestinians. And I do think it's going to get worse. I think you won't see it to the point where, you know, any of these Democrats are going to come out and openly support BDS. I don't think you'll see it. It won't be anything like that. But I will think that they'll sit there and they'll talk about illegal settlements and things of that nature. They'll pay a lot more lip service, I think, especially in the primaries. Maybe not so much in the general election, but the primaries to the left wing base that's going to try and get them the nomination.
That's interesting. I mean, it's always been the dependable, as close as we could get to dependable bipartisan views.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, you're,
fine
you're
Democrats
true.
And Republicans would That's be right. for Israel.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody like Biden, for example, won't, you know, Biden will be out there, you know, with his strong I'm an Israel supporter chops.
Yeah, but they'll find some nuance. You know they will. They'll find a way to be both.
Possibly, you know? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm pro-Israel, but does that mean I'm pro-Netanyahu? He's basically a Trumpkin. You know, like they...
Yeah, there you go.
That's what they'll move to.
There you go. All right, Andrea, so tell us, what's in the news? What do you got for us? Anything good?
Oh, well, so I just have a couple of fun things. So news wise, so everyone knows, at least they should know by now. If they don't know me, I'm from the Pacific Northwest, now living in Virginia, but Seattle is in a snowstorm, but people in Seattle are still hoping that despite the snow, their first democracy vouchers are going to be sent out this week. You get $100 sent to you from the government of Seattle to then pay back into to give to your candidate of choice for the 2019 election season. So,
Well, that's sweet. Yeah. How about they do this? How about they sit there and use the money to get their kids vaccinated in certain areas of that state?
Yeah, or get some of the homeless situation under control. Yeah, that would be great. But other than that, I have a couple. I have a fun thing for you guys with Valentine's Day coming up. Mental Floss has listed the top. They've got both the top movie in each state, romantic comedy in each state, and then they also have the top Netflix movie in each state. And then I was looking at your state. Your state is Doc Hollywood, which just, I didn't even.
And just so people know, Ben's in South Carolina.
Yeah. I didn't even know that Doc Hollywood was a romantic comedy. Like, I never thought of it.
Yeah. It's definitely a romantic comedy. But did they have anything for people who are alone and suffering from crippling depression?
You know, I don't.
Just let me know if they have that.
Yeah, well, you know, Virginia, which is the state that Jay and I are in, has the movie Hitch. So, you know, the Hitch is for people who, you know, he's the antidote to people who are sad and lonely. And
that's right. That's super funny.
So what does Washington have?
Of course, it's the creepy movie, but also the beloved Sleepless in Seattle. Nora Ephron really, like, you know, went out of her way to be creepy with that movie. I still don't understand. Like, I watch it now and I think, how creepy is this movie? Meg Ryan basically plays a psychopath in that movie.
Yeah, she's a stalker.
Yeah.
I've actually never seen it.
Oh, man, you watch it now. I mean, if you watched it 25, 30 years ago, you would think, oh, it's so cute. It's adorable. Now you watch it in the day of an age of the internet and stuff like that, and you're like, oh, my God, run for the hills.
Yeah. That's the way with a lot of movies. My mom watched My Fair Lady a lot growing up. And have you watched that recently?
My daughter loves it.
It's
basically a guy who abducts a young woman off the street.
Abducts a young woman and tells her what a piece of trash she is, trains her in how to be an elitist, verbally abuses her, and then she falls in love with him.
Yeah, it's a Stockholm Syndrome.
Right. And on a bet, by the way. So,
yeah, on a bet, yeah. And
very romantic.
Musicals.
Yeah, musicals are just terrible. So it's that's it. That's the news.
That's the news for right now. I mean, you guys have talked for quite a long time. I didn't know how much you guys. With Valentine's Day coming up, I'm sure you guys will be really really happy to know that Kate Gosselin of John and Kate Plus Eight fame, she's back on the market and is doing a dating show. And her oldest daughters are really excited. So, you know, if you're looking for that woman that has eight kids and, you know, have a nasty divorce, she's there for you.
Oh, that sounds like the kind of baggage.
And you know who's like making like a comeback in terms of like being brought back onto TV as this kind of like victim person was who's the one that chopped off her husband's thing.
Oh, Benet, John, wait.
No, so, not John Benet Ramsey.
Lorena Bobbitt.
Lorena Bobbitt.
Yeah.
You said John Benet Ramsey.
I said John Benet Ramsey, right. Lorena Bobbitt.
Yeah, Lorena Bobbitt.
Oh, my God.
I do love that like the difference between male and female abuse is such that she maimed a man in his sexual organ, and what is she getting? Like a reality show or something?
Something like that. There's like a podcast or something is being done. She's kind of been on the talk show circuit. And look, I don't want to downplay the abuse that she suffered. Clearly, you know, it was a reaction. But at the same time, it's like, I don't think you should treat somebody as a hero for doing something like that. I mean,
I didn't know the backstory. Did he beat her or something like that? I didn't know.
I think she claimed that he abused her, and that's part of the reason why she did it. I think at the time, though, it was like she did it because she thought maybe he was cheating on her or something, but it may have gone deeper than that. I don't know. The whole thing just seems a little, like, weird. I mean, this is like from, like, the mid-1990s. This is like one of those things where people are like looking it up on Wikipedia because they have no idea what the hell it is. And they're like,
we've got all these movies now that are basically reboots of old movies. And everybody keeps saying we're running out of ideas. We're running out of ideas in reality. we're actually recycling old tabloids. That's just crazy.
Well, look at what happened now. The Netflix, one of the biggest series on there is the Ted Bundy tapes.
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
We just have too much access.
I enjoyed the Ted Bundy tapes very much.
It's pretty scary. I enjoyed them very much.
When it all comes down to it, you know, the people love horrible stuff. I mean, the Colosseum from thousands of years ago was just people dying to watch another guy kill someone else. And that's basically what reality television is, just our Colosseum now. And what better gladiator than somebody who's chopped a guy's dick off, I guess.
There you go. Well, that's going to be the final word. So for my co-host, Ben Howe, just so you guys know, I'm sure you guys, he's told you, but still, he's got a book coming out in August. Is it still August? Oh, yeah. August release date?
Yeah, it's still August. That's right.
So the Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. And this stems from a piece that you wrote, I think, in The Atlantic. After you wrote that, you kind of got the people were out there.
Got the attention for it. Yeah, you know what's interesting is when people hear the name of the book, I get this all the time, people are just, they immediately assume that it's like all of this, I have the vapors over sexual content of Trump's adulterous nature. It's really not what it's about. It's about what I was talking about earlier, which is the way that people have grown to defend the indefensible in favor of their self-interests.
Right. I mean, I think a perfect example of maybe somebody you're talking about, maybe not mentioned specifically, but be like Jerry Falwell Jr.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm from Liberty. I mean, my dad went there. My mom worked there. My sister worked there or went to school there. So I went to his church, his father's church. And, you know, this was a guy whose father I was taken to a march by my parents when I was a kid. There was an anti-Playboy magazine march. And then in 2016, I'm seeing his son, Cheesy Grin, with a thumbs up in front of a Playboy cover, giving, you know, Trump the nod. And I'm just like, wow, things have changed a little bit.
Yeah, he said Trump's State of the Union was the best that he has ever heard and said he's the greatest president since George Washington.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, it's such a mistake to allow evangelical leaders, Christian leaders, to get this involved in the political process, because there's just no way you don't create idols. And that's what they do. They create idols. They're creating a cult of personality. They're contributing to it. And then when they want to stay right, they want to stay correct, they find biblical rationalizations to defend anything he does. And all they're doing is diminishing what they're supposed to be teaching. They should freaking stay out of it.
It's terrible. So, all right. So you have the book coming out. Tell everybody else where they can find you.
You can follow me on Twitter at Ben Howe. And sometimes appear at Daily Beast. That's pretty much it.
All right. And Andrea, where can everybody find you?
At Arc Digital now and at Andrea and Ruth on Twitter.
Yeah, you're associate editor over there now, right?
Yep.
All right. And don't forget, Andrea has her own podcast with Kim Ross, aka Southern Keeks, on Twitter, called The Right Side, and that's you want to go and listen to that as well. I'm Jay Caruso, deputy editor of the Washington Examiner magazine. You can find me at Jay Caruso on Twitter. Remember, go to iTunes. You know this was a 5-star podcast, so go give it a 5-star rating. Leave us a review. Make everyone happy here. And we'll love you for it, at least for this week. And we'll see you next time on The Fifth Estate.